2. Sweet Virginia. I'd been talking to McAfee for 2 weeks with an hour-long call every 3 days or so. Initially, we started formally. Send Janice an email to book a call into my schedule and we'll go from there, he told me. It became apparent that there was no schedule. He wasn't doing anything else as far as I could see. Wherever he was in the world, I never asked, but based on time zone daylight, I'm guessing it was somewhere in Central Europe, he wasn't exactly operating on standard business hours. Often when I spoke to him, he had either just gotten up or was drinking. Sometimes he had just gotten up and was drinking. Other times, he was still in bed. It was all a bit disorganized, and there always seemed to be people building in the background of wherever it was that he was living. Drilling, hammering, contractors erecting what looked like partition walls. People came and went, some speaking very little English. One was introduced to me on Skype as he walked past with an industrial nail gun. He waved. I gave him the thumbs up. Junior was his name. From there, we abandoned the formal arranging through Janice and just sent each other messages on Skype, instant messenger, instead. To the best of my knowledge, McAfee never used a cell phone for regular phone calls, nor did he use any of the standard messaging apps to communicate. For whatever reason, Skype was the only way he'd willingly engage. That is, until he stopped. At one point before the 3rd week of calls, McAfee disappeared altogether. Although we had a firm time for a scheduled call, he didn't pick the call up when I rang. When I instant messaged to ask if he needed to reschedule, the message was read, but no response came back. I went back to Janice with a polite request for another date, and there was no response to that email either. Part of me thought he might have been captured. A bigger part of me felt sure I would have heard about that online. I just left it for a few days. I could see he was active. Skype showed his status as online at various times. Paranoid, I went through everything we'd discussed to that point in my head and wondered if there was anything he'd told me that he might have wished he hadn't. I couldn't think of anything. I knew he was edgy about discussing some of the events that took place in Belize. We'd touched on that era, but had hardly got into any depth yet. In any case, at the outset, he'd told me he had nothing to hide on that front anyway. I then wondered if it was our business arrangement, which was loose, to put it mildly, that was putting him off. All we'd agreed was that, in the event of a publishing deal, we'd split the proceeds and figure out the exact percentages when we knew what we were dividing. We were both pretty relaxed about that side of it all, I thought. On one hand, McAfee's disappearance was a bit strange because he'd been readily engaging and seemed enthusiastic, borderline excited, to get through as much material as we could. On another, it was probably what I expected. It was John McAfee, after all. What did I expect? And then, out of nowhere, after a week of no contact, he reappeared as if nothing had happened, although to his credit, he did apologize for not making the initial call and arranged another for the following day. In the interim, an email arrived which contained the following provisional foreword, written by him, along with a note that explained that he wanted all of the book proceeds to go to the person named, or rather not named, in the below. I have been urged for years by my friends to put my life down on paper. It seemed like a step back from newer means of laying out a life, and I always sidestepped the suggestion. I am lazy by nature and would not attempt a project such as writing my autobiography in the absence of duress. That duress arrived when Janice and I went into hiding after our arrest in the Dominican Republic. The man that stepped up and offered assistance gave us food, shelter, and the promise of security. Having temporarily exhausted our resources, my offer of repayment was to spend the time, so freely provided by my host, writing my autobiography and giving full rights to the book and all proceeds thereof to my host. Once I have an obligation, I do carry it out, and my host fulfilled his end of the promise as well. Janice and I are now free to move, with restrictions, about the world. His many months of shelter saved our lives, and this book is dedicated to him, though he must remain nameless. Obviously, this email and the suggestion within it that all the book proceeds would be going to some anonymous person was a little unsettling. I called him on Skype for an explanation. "Oh, there's no issue," McAfee said. "Don't worry about the business side of things. I'll take care of that." "I understand," I said, "but I need to know exactly where I stand before we go much further." How about if you take 35% of all revenues and I take 65%, he said. And you pay your guy from your share, not off the top, right? I asked. Yes, McAfee replied. That's very generous, thanks, I said. Thereafter, neither the forward nor the mystery beneficiary was ever mentioned again. But at least he and I were back on track with the conversations. Me. We finished last time with you saying that your relationship with your dad taught you a lot about people. Why was that? John McAfee. Okay, yes, that's right. I learned to read people because of my dad. Not that he knew how to read people himself at all. He was an alcoholic and not the nicest of people. He worked as a road surveyor by day and he drank at night. And when he became unhappy with any situation in his immediate environment, which was often, he'd simply lash out at the closest thing that was able to feel something, and that was usually me. But I wasn't stupid. I adapted. I became extraordinarily attentive to him, not just to his moods themselves, but also to the subtle position of his hands before a bad mood even came on, or the way he might look or how he smiled or didn't smile at a certain moment. The reason for that study was that when a mood came on, it was too late. I learned to preempt, and this was done entirely from a place of self-preservation. Of course, these moods of his could be joyful as much as they could be angry. Either way, I had to learn to recognize the signs and behave accordingly. When he was drinking and happy, well, fuck me, I could have burned the house down and that would have been fine with him. But when he was angry, I knew I had to be on my best fucking behavior, otherwise he'd lash out. I learned all this because I wanted to do nothing that would ever push that motherfucker over the edge. Me. Did your dad physically beat you? John McAfee. Every kid got the belt when I was a kid. Please, God, if you think there's a single man of my age who was not whipped with a belt more times than he can count, then you are delusional. Do you call that a beating? Sometimes I suppose it was, but I got the belt all the time, yes, and the fact that I did was neither here nor there. It wasn't like I was the only one getting beaten in our neighborhood. Nobody was saying, poor John, he gets the belt. Every kid was getting the same shit. Meanwhile, my relationship with my mother was always good. She was a very hard-working, long-suffering woman, typical of that generation. She went to church every Sunday and worked at the bank part-time. She was charismatic, joyful, and social. Her bridge club met in our house every Wednesday afternoon. My mother was a good woman, and on reflection, I never really understood the love she clearly had for my father. Me. What did you learn from having to preempt your father's moods? John McAfee. By the time I was 12, I could tell by the sound my father's shoes made when he walked across the hall what kind of mood he was in. Accordingly, I'd either be jovial with him, or I'd just pick up my books and go to my room. I instinctively knew which to do and when. And my point is that once you've learned how to read one person, you definitely notice how valuable that ability is as a tool in all human relationships. I was never the biggest, the strongest, or the fastest kid in my neighborhood. But I was the boss of every fucking neighborhood I ever lived in because I became adept at reading people and treating them accordingly. The same applied to every company I've ever worked in. I have applied these abilities to understand what makes another person tick ever since childhood and have always treated people the same no matter what because of that. Even today, if a derelict dude comes up to me in the street, I'll give him money. But at the same time, I'll look into his eyes and have a conversation, assuming one is possible. It's all the same to me. I have never in my life judged anyone. Me. Would you describe these years in Salem, Virginia as happy? John McAfee. We moved to Salem from Bristol, Tennessee when I was 6, and we stayed there until I was 19 and left home to go to college in Roanoke. And I would say that, in spite of my father's moods, these were the happiest days of my life. Our house was right beside the woods, and when we reached a certain level of maturity, we were given the freedom to cycle into the woods, build tree houses, and at times, camp out there for an entire weekend at a time. Obviously, we'd have to check in at home every once in a while, or we voluntarily came back because we needed something trivial like more milk. But generally, I remember having this real sense of liberation in that house. If you summed the whole time up, it was idyllic. Me. Did you do well in school? John McAfee. I wouldn't say I was especially smart, but I did what the teachers told me to do. Basically, I obeyed, and again, I learned this as a result of having to figure my own father out. When someone is older than you, outweighs you by a factor of 10, you do exactly what they tell you to do. Metaphorically, within that system, teachers represented the same thing. They could punish me, expel me, and call the police or whatever. I didn't want any of that, so I did exactly what I was told, but no more. I didn't study, never did homework, but when it came to the tests, I aced every single one of them. Me. Were you made to go to church? John McAfee. Oh, fuck yes. The Episcopal Church. I was a mini-Catholic. I sang in the choir. I was an altar boy, too. I went to Sunday school. The Book of Common Prayer I could recite verbatim, and I don't know why, because it's all utter nonsense. Even at 7 years old, I was questioning what God was, not because of religion per se, but because I was asking myself, what the fuck is this thing, life, that I'm in? I mean, you appear on Earth at the age of zero, gain some semblance of consciousness at the age of two, and then there you are on a fucking scooter in your parents' yard at the age of seven thinking, what the fuck am I even doing here? At the time, I genuinely thought about these things with whatever capacity I had at the time. I've questioned everything about life ever since, including my own perceptions. Me. Women, lots of them, have been a big part of your life. Do you remember when you were first alerted to the attractions of the opposite sex? John McAfee. It's true. It would be impossible to tell my story without explaining the framework where women fit in. And I'm about to move outside to continue this talk because it's a conversation where the words I'm about to say should not be allowed to reverberate around inside a closed space. They need air. I kissed my first woman when I was 8 years old. The girl who sat beside me in class was the daughter of a dentist, and I remembered that she had these blue jeans that, when she folded them up, you could see the Scottish plaid lining on the inside. I thought they were the cutest. I thought she was cuter. One afternoon, I followed her home through the woods between school and where she lived. We all walked home. It was this tiny little town. I ran up to her, kissed her on the cheek, and then ran away. Good God, that was the most thrilling moment of my life up until that time, and perhaps even now. Even in my most drugged-out states in later life, I don't think I've ever recaptured the divinity of what I experienced that day. Me. How did you feel in that precise moment? John McAfee. You want to talk about a surge of emotion and love? This was it. There was absolutely no sexual attachment to this event, but I did feel desire of some kind. I received a momentary glimpse into an adult world that obviously I didn't understand. The thrill that I felt in that 1/8 of a second peck on the cheek was like a bolt of lightning that showed me what life might be like. At the moment my lips touched her skin, I thought, okay, this is where I'm headed. Me. How did she respond? John McAfee. It's hard to say because I ran off so fast, just grabbed a kiss and ran. But I don't think she reacted in any way negatively. Some would say that that was my first criminal act, molestation. You know that it would be called that today, and I'm willing to talk about it openly. If anyone has a problem with it, we are in serious trouble. Me. What was your next experience with a woman? John McAfee. Well, as I grew older, I started becoming much more aware of sex and that our purpose on this planet is to propagate. Obviously, there was no internet back then, but we did have occasional access to a copy or two of my dad's Playboy magazines, which we all sat around and shared in our teenage years. That was our porn hub. Playboy magazine aside, there was nothing to do in that tiny town. There was a school, three restaurants, and an amusement park that was closed all winter. But there was a skating rink within walking distance of our houses, and I was one of the few in my peer group who got into skating at all. It was considered pretty dorky by my friends in those days, but the way I saw it, it wasn't them I was trying to fuck. No, I had noticed that if you wanted to find girls, they were most likely at that goddamn skating rink. So I got pretty good to the extent that I could skate backward, talking, etc., and could then fly by a girl, wink, or say something complimentary like, "My, I like how you fixed your hair." Me. And the sexual experience was at the skating rink? John McAfee. No, but it was this place that led me down the path of my actual sexual experience at the age of 15 with a 21-year-old woman named Jill. She was extremely attractive and I met her at the skating rink. But the problem was that she was engaged to an older man. Regardless, the truth of the matter is that she got me involved in her life as opposed to me gatecrashing hers. At first, she got me involved in her church. It was the summer of 1960. All of us were off school. Meanwhile, her boyfriend had a regular job and was at work every day while she sat around at home all week with nothing to do. It started with her taking me for drives in her car, and then those drives in the car turned into us parking the car somewhere and kissing. She and I just burned up the month of June. We were going out almost every day and doing this. It was such a great time. Me, did it go further? John McAfee, it took me weeks to pluck up the courage to touch this woman at all. Also, because of her religious beliefs, she was still a virgin, albeit she was engaged to this guy, and had been for months, possibly even years. However, one night, a month or so after we started kissing, her fiancé had to go to Richmond for the weekend. So we went out to a drive-in movie in her car. Meanwhile, my mother was extremely concerned about all this. What are you doing with this woman going out at night? She was very conservative in that sense. If she'd had her way, I'd still be a virgin today. However, that night in the car, we went all the way. I took her from behind in the back seat. Back in those days, there was something called a party line, where maybe 100 people in the neighbourhood could share a phone line by jumping on and off. Obviously, there was no privacy. People used to spy on what their neighbours were saying and doing. Well, later that night, Jill called and we talked, specifically about some of the acts we'd performed earlier that evening. I loved it when you did me from behind, etc. The problem was the brother of a friend of mine heard all of this and immediately told Jill's fiancé. Me. Was that the end of the affair? John McAfee. At church the following Wednesday, it all came out. I was there, Jill was there with her fiancé, and my friend's brother was asked to lead the prayer that night. He stood up and said, I need a private prayer with John. He also requested that Jill's fiancé be there too, and let's just say that he was one angry motherfucker at this point. But my friend's brother took control of the situation simply because his younger brother, with whom I'd built tree houses while growing up, had said, don't let him kill my friend John. My friend's brother, who was a mean motherfucker himself, just said words to the effect of, it ends tonight, and from now on, you need to be more careful. My first love affair was over, and that, at the time, was an absolute tragedy. Did this first experience with the opposite sex spur you on to discover more? John McAfee. It took me a month to summon up the courage to even go back to the skating rink. I never saw Jill there again, but another girl, Annie, an excellent skater herself, was second in line for my eyes. A couple of weeks later, she and I had sex and that started a sequence of conquests, possibly 15 or so, all in this little town. By the next year, I'd lost count of how many women I'd slept with, but one of them of particular note was Sue. She was as cute as hell, but also one of the freest women I'd ever met. She was way above me in terms of understanding herself. She was just such a wild bitch. We had wild sex exclusively in cars, and she also got me into stealing. Me. Had you ever stolen before? Were you stealing for any particular reason? John McAfee. I hadn't, and it was just for the thrill of it all. She didn't need the items she stole, or money. Her parents were very well off. But her speciality was stealing small items like silver spoons from antique stores in neighbouring towns, which tended to be looked after by one person who could easily be distracted. The act of stealing was just so exciting to me, even though we never did anything with the stuff we stole. Later we got into stealing bicycles, which was a lot scarier and much more dangerous. Instead of stealing from antique stores from under the noses of 80-year-old lady proprietors, who looked at me as if I was their sweet grandson, now we were going to residences and stealing bikes from garages and off front porches. A whole different ball game that was. Eventually, we literally had a basement full of fucking bicycles, to the point where Sue's dad kept saying, where are these coming from? Oh, John has a new bicycle repair business, she told him. Some we gave away, others we even took back, but not to the people we had stolen them from. Trying to take them back was every bit as much fun. We'd go into neighbourhoods at 2 o'clock in the morning, look at a house and say, it looks like kids live here, and then we'd just leave a bike on the porch and drive away. We could fit 4 bikes in the car at once. Me. Did you ever get caught? John McAfee. No, of course not. We were 2 smart kids, 16 or 17 years old. We were never going to get caught. We also started breaking into parked cars, which was obviously different in those days before central locking. By creeping around baseball stadium parking lots 100 miles away, where nobody knew us or had ever seen us, and where we knew nobody would be watching, we had our way many times. You wouldn't believe what we collected. Cameras, binoculars, cash. None of it was ever put to any use. But again, it was the most fun I'd ever had, and furthermore, it made me realize that if you don't secure your shit in life, you do not deserve that shit. There is always going to be someone out there, like Sue and I were back then, who is ready to take it from you. That's what some young people do. They just want thrills. And believe me, there is no bigger thrill than risking your entire reputation by doing something that you know society is going to universally condemn. Imagine how that old lady in the antique store, who once looked at you like her grandson, would look at you if she knew that you had her silver spoons in your pocket. That's a big fucking risk to take on every level, but for me, it was a risk worth taking. It was physically arousing. While doing this, I'd inevitably get erections, and Sarah would often get wet, so we'd park the car somewhere, run into the woods, and fuck like wild bears. Me. Was there a special one among these early girlfriends? John McAfee. Without question, a girl called Alexa, who I also met at the Episcopal Church in Salem, although she actually came from nearby Roanoke. Meanwhile, my family could only be described as very sub-middle class in the sense that my parents, even when my dad was still around, never had much in the way of wealth. Right from the start, this was a problem with Alexa's parents. She personally didn't care, but her parents certainly didn't want her running around with someone as low class as they thought I was. We started an affair that lasted for a number of years. It wasn't ever an exclusive arrangement, certainly not as far as I was concerned, but whenever she was home for vacations, we would get together. I would park my mother's car up the hill from her house around midnight and sneak through backyards and into Alexa's bedroom via her by then opened window, where we'd have endless, silent sex all night long. Me. Was there something specific that attracted, drew you to Alexa? John McAfee. She was smart, and she was also a fucking rebel. Now, if you can find a rich girl who is also a rebel, you're onto something, my friend. This relationship continued into my first year in college, when she was attending school up in Washington, D.C. Thereafter, she resurfaced many times over the years, until as recently as 30 years ago. It was all so long ago. Fuck me, time flies so fast, Mark. How old are you, my friend? Me. I'm almost 50. John McAfee. Ah, that age of transition of thought, where you go from looking forward to looking backward. When you get to my age, when you look forward, there isn't much there. But when you look back, there's a wealth of experience and information. That experience is important to reflect on for any person. Some people never do it, others do it constantly. The latter is the group of people I want to be with and talk to. Often I can learn more by looking into someone's eyes than from anything that they say. For a few minutes, we detoured in one of those wistful moments I enjoyed most with McAfee. It was during these periods of reflection where his eyes were at their kindest and simultaneously their saddest. McAfee, for all his bravado, definitely could be vulnerable. I could sense that this was a man who had lived a fulfilling life, but also one who had deep regrets and pain about aspects that he knew he could never hope to fix. I knew that the relationship he had with his father was a subject that he'd rarely talked about in interviews over the years. I wanted to tread carefully on it out of respect for his feelings. But at the same time, I knew that his father was one of the most significant people in his life, not because he showed love or was inspiring in any way, but because he informed almost all of McAfee's behaviors in later life. Me. I know how sensitive this is, but how did your father's suicide affect you? John McAfee. I was 16 at the time, and I'm going to have to be really honest with you here. It felt pretty good. Don't get me wrong, I cried. I wasn't the kind of kid who laughed at funerals, and at that time I felt hurt because he was no longer in my life. But at the same time, there was this other part of me that was saying, "Dude, do you understand what this means?" It was freedom. My dad represented the last thing that was ever going to control any part of my life. By that point, I had teachers wrapped around my finger and my mother the same. Dealing with my father had trained me well in terms of how to predict what people might want now, or in 2 minutes, or in 2 hours. And now that he was gone, there was nobody left who was controlling me, and in the case of teachers, they didn't need to anyway, as I was already obedient. It sounds strange, probably, but I really saw my dad's death, as much as it was the end of his life, as the beginning of mine at the time. Me. How do you feel about your father nowadays? John McAfee. Well, I'll say this much. My father has been a looming presence in my entire life in a way that I didn't expect when I was 15. He's been with me every day since the day he died. Every situation of mistrust I find myself in, he is the sole negotiator of that mistrust. As much as I never truly felt his love, he has never gone away. Me. What did this sense of liberty that you felt after your father died make you want to do with your life thereafter? John McAfee. I wouldn't say that I had any clear aspirations in high school, but I definitely knew what I liked. The sciences interested me. Chemistry, biology, physics. Of the three, physics was my greatest love, and because of that affinity, I ended up going to nearby Roanoke College on a physics scholarship in September of 1963. However, my issue was, and has always been, laziness. Laziness has killed every ambition I've ever had in my life. Even McAfee Associates, years later, I never really wanted to do. It just kind of happened. But in my first semester at college, I found myself looking around and thinking, God damn, there are a lot of classes. Not only that, I discovered that in order to get a physics degree, I also had to take every fucking math class that I would have to take to get a math degree. I thought, fuck this, I'm just doing math. Me. Path of least resistance? I'm assuming you found math easy. John McAfee. I have always approached everything in life from a mathematical perspective, including relationships. Everything to me is formulaic in some way, and even as a college student, I didn't have to work at any of it. It was all in my head. So there I was at college, with a curriculum that would get me a fucking degree, and then a job, and to get all that, I didn't have to do a fucking ounce of work. In high school, if you didn't show up to class, you got suspended. But at college, nobody fucking cared. Every now and then, I would check in to make sure I wasn't completely self-deluded in what was happening, but in general, I sailed through. I never once showed up to class. I had fallen into the Garden of Eden. My first semester in pure math, I got straight A's, having done not a stroke of work. All I ever did was read the textbooks, which, incidentally, is something nobody else ever did. They showed up to class, hoping that the professor would somehow impart the knowledge to them, either by force or osmosis. All they needed to do was read the fucking textbook. My view was always, why would I need that son of a bitch to teach me when all he's done is read this shit to be able to teach me? Fuck him, I'll read this myself. Mostly it took me less than a day to read the entire book anyway. I could solve the math problems in a matter of minutes. Me. I assumed you partied at college. John McAfee. Hell yes, I drank like crazy. I had never really drunk in high school, so you could say I was a late starter, but a quick learner. I never did a lick of work, had my own apartment on campus, and I had a whole series of entrepreneurial jobs that I did to make a fortune on the side. The best of them was a subscription sales job with a company called Ben Franklin Magazines. In these days, long before the internet, this company had created a money-making paradigm selling magazines in the mail. They made no money whatsoever from the magazine subscriptions themselves, but they did make money through advertising. And that advertising was based on the number of subscribers. If you had 500,000 readers, you were in Fat City. The production's costs were next to nothing. So Ben Franklin Magazines went to all the major titles, Homes and Gardens, Men's Journal, Field and Stream, etc., and said, "If we can get you real subscribers and prove that they have paid, will you give us the magazines for free?" They said something along the lines of course, but you can't do that shit. Ben Franklin Magazine said, just watch us. Me. Where did you fit into all this? John McAfee. Well, this buddy of mine told me about this job going door to door selling these subscriptions, and he said, dude, you would be perfect for this. I went to their offices in Roanoke, and when I walked in, there was basically this warehouse with hundreds of women on the phone. I got taken into the office and had the system explained, all of which began with these women on the phone. Hello, Mrs. Jones. This is Catherine from Ben Franklin Magazines. Mrs. Jones, have you ever won anything before? Why, no. Well, you might want to sit down because you have just won a 5-year free subscription to any magazine of your choice. I know you're having a hard time believing this, so we're going to send our route manager out to you tomorrow to give you your guarantee. I became one of 2 dozen of these route managers, and I came into the office whenever the fuck I wanted every day and said, "Okay, what leads have you got?" Then I'd go out, college dude, charismatic smile, etc., knock on the door and say, "Mrs. Jones, John McAfee from Ben Franklin Magazines. I just want to say congratulations, and by the way, can I come in?" Me: "I'm guessing being a salesman came naturally to you." John McAfee: "Of course. I'd get invited in, offered tea or coffee, and then from there I'd explain that while the magazines were absolutely free, we asked that the customer only paid the mailing charges, which amounted to 84 cents per week. Now, Mrs. Jones, you don't want to have to write a check for 84 cents a week for 5 years, do you? That would be 250 checks. Wouldn't it be easier to just write a check for the full amount today?" Meanwhile, while I'm saying this, I'm pulling out this great fold-out display of all the magazines available, and she's saying, "Oh my, you have knitting magazines." And I'm thinking, "Yeah, who gives a shit?" Well, maybe 2 out of 10 people would write me a check there and then for the full amount. Others would choose the payment plan that allowed 2 payments, and the rest would pay 1/5 annually. I was guaranteed to get to keep that 1/5 check every time I went out. Me: "Did you ever run into any problems?" John McAfee: "Occasionally, I'd get a husband who'd answer the door and say, 'Why don't you get an honest goddamn job?' That would happen now and again. It was pointless showing up on the weekend to deal with some husband, the guy who was earning the money and knew the real value of it. No, I needed to speak to the wives, sitting at home bored out of their minds every day, wanting some free magazines. I just adapted and made sure I showed up on weekdays." Me: "How lucrative was this operation?" John McAfee: "I probably closed 6 deals every time I went out. That amounted to around $300 a day. Meanwhile, I was a fucking college student whose apartment only cost $60 a month. You can figure that out, my friend. I had more money than I knew what to do with, and before long I went straight out and bought a brand new MGB sports car. I paid $3,000 in cash. And that wasn't even the most lucrative job I had. At one point, I set myself up as an interior designer without actually knowing anything about design per se. Nevertheless, I had a good eye for how things could be. I read some books, figured it out, and because there were no other interior designers in Roanoke at the time, I landed enough jobs to make almost $30,000 in a year. And the work was good. I have always had a good design ethic." Me: "So you weren't exactly living the standard college student life?" John McAfee: "You're not kidding. I had a sports car, was living not in a fucking frat house, but in my own pad, and was getting more pussy than God. I was totally free from all the normal nonsense of college, all that dorm room shit and stupid regulations about when I could come and go. And because I never went to class, I basically had free time 24 hours of the day until exam time or term paper time came. I could do what I wanted, whenever I wanted, and that became the theme for my entire life. From the age of 17, all I have ever wanted is to just be me. I didn't want fucking rules because they told me to be something other than me. At some point, they tried to induct me into some kind of rules-based stupid fraternity, but I just walked away from that shit. The rules for being me were rules only I could make." Me: "Did you apply this mode of thinking to every aspect of your life thereafter?" John McAfee: "I challenge you to find a single thing I have ever done that does not adhere to that principle." Me: "You mentioned you still saw Alexa while you were at college." John McAfee: "I did, but while I was at poor man's school, she was at one of the better schools, just outside Washington, D.C. So, every Friday, I used to drive up there in my MGB, and she'd sneak out of school to spend the entire weekend with me. We'd check into a motel somewhere and just go and party in Georgetown. Sometimes we didn't sleep for 48 hours. It was heavenly. But this part of the story is sad for me to relate even today. Her parents hired private detectives, and they found out that she and I had been seeing each other. They then forced her to tell me that it was over, and she did so one Sunday as we were driving back from Washington. I was heartbroken. I had to have my head out the car window while we were driving because I just couldn't breathe because of the overall sense of sadness. I was despondent for weeks. I tried to call, but all the numbers had been changed. I couldn't have exactly shown up at her house either. Her father was a powerful man and might well have had me whacked. It would be years until we were in contact again, but by the time we did, the mad attraction that we shared as teenagers was no longer there.